All right. So remember what the whole operation here is. We keep alternating between, we have a stack of cards, we pick a pivot, and then we have to run through. So the time-consuming thing is running through that list and splitting it on either side of the pivot, finding the thing that's going to be kind of the midpoint, putting things some to the left and some to the right. Each time we touch one of these cards, it takes some amount of time. But what happens each time we touch a card? It came from a stack of some size, and then it gets put into a stack that's going to be smaller, right? It's a split stack. So if we have n cards here, then you know more or less we have n to the left of the, n over 2 to the left of the pivot and n over 2 to the right. So each time I touch this card, with high probability, it's going to join a smaller group. In fact, the size of that group is going to be about half the size of the group that it started in. So how many times, if we start off in the list of n, this is one card in the list of n, how many times do I touch this card? Once when it's in a stack of n, once when it's in a stack of n over 2, once when it's in a stack of n over 4, once when it's in a stack of n over 8, and eventually it's all by itself and it's sorted. We don't have to touch it again. How many times did I touch this card? How many times can you go from n, n over 2, n over 4? How many times can I split n in half before I get down to 1? That's log n. So this card gets touched log n times. In fact, all of these cards, each of these cards gets touched log n times. How many cards are there? N. So what's the total? This one's log n, this one's log n, this one's log n. All n of them are log n. So the total number of times I have to touch a card, which is where all the time is taking place, is n times the log of n. So on average, quicksort sorts the list of n elements in n log n time. So that's great. In fact, that's so much better than n squared that when you actually run these on a computer, you see, you know, things like selection sort and bubble sort that take n squared, you give it a million elements, and you just, it's just grueling, just watching it just, and making barely any progress. And you give it quicksort, and it goes, done. It's really pretty. And there's little animations on the web that you can find that are, it's just remarkable. How could it possibly be that fast? So the improvement from n squared to n log n is really enormous. All right. The last little bit of the notes, and the last little bit of chapter 5 talks about heuristics. Hillis makes a distinction between algorithms, things that we know are going to work and produce the right answer, and heuristics, which are kind of like algorithms, but they don't always have to work. And if you've got, you may remember this this subset sum problem. When I give you a list of numbers, and I say, is there a subset of these numbers that adds up to some target, like 433? And that's a hard problem. There are algorithms for it, but they basically involve, you know, enumerating all the different sets of numbers. But there's heuristics, like the heuristics that you guys used when you tried to solve this, especially you, where you said, hey, let's get something that's near 433, and then we'll swap things in and out until we hone in on the right answer. It's not guaranteed to always work, but it often works, and when it often works quite fast. So heuristics turn out to be this really powerful idea for solving problems that we don't know any better way to solve. But I don't think we can really get too deep into it in this class. But there's a lot of what happens in the field of artificial intelligence, my subfield of computer science, is about coming up with good heuristics, because we generally deal with problems that are too hard to solve exactly. So you can look at the notes, and also he talks about it in the chapter 2 if you want to look a little bit more into heuristics and how they work. But that really is the end of chapter 5. All right, so what I'd like to do now is jump into chapter 6. Here we are. All right, so we have some time to get into this. There's basically one trick that I'd like you to learn in chapter 6, which is about building certain kinds of codes, and I'll kind of work you through that. So in chapter 6, Hillis talks about a whole bunch of different interesting topics having to do with how do you encode messages in patterns of bits. And he mentions Huffman coding, at least indirectly. But I thought it would be worth kind of looking at it in a little bit more detail. Good night. So I made the claim in the beginning of the semester that just about anything that you might care about, you can express in terms of bits. Pictures and sound and algorithms and stories and I don't know too much about digital smell, but I'm pretty sure there is such a thing. And so things can be represented as patterns of ones and zeros. But there's many, in fact, there's not just one way to represent something as a pattern of ones and zeros. There's often lots and lots of ways. So how do you choose? When people were designing a system for manipulating pictures or sound, they had lots of choices to make. What could possibly matter? Well, there generally are these two things that are in conflict with each other that they have to choose between. They want something that's easily manipulated. So usually, if you're encoding something in bits, you're trying to put it there so that you can use it later. So depending on what you're going to use it for, it may matter about how you encode it in terms of bits. So if, for example, if it's something like a song, you might want the bits that are encoded. You might want bits to correspond to different moments in the song, and you might want them to be roughly in the same order, the same temporal order as the song. Why? Because a program that's going to then play back this song later should be able to look, know where to look for the next piece of the song. It should be a nice, consistent pattern. Okay. So that's on the one side, you want it to be easily manipulated, but on the other side, you'd like it to be as small as possible, right? If we're trying to represent something, we want to use as few bits as we can. Why? Because we're going to have to store those bits, and if we want to transmit them to someone, we have to send those bits. And the more bits, the more space it's going to take up, and the more time it's going to take to send it. So sometimes in computers, they'll actually do the trade-off differently at different times. So do you know what sort of thing I'm thinking about? You might have a file that's set up for easy use, but then later, you might want to change it to something that's more compact for storage, but not as easy to use. Have you ever done that with your computer? Ever hear that idea? It comes up a lot. Like, what do you do if the amount that you're trying to store on your computer becomes too high? You need to make room for more. So you change the format that something's stored into to what kind of format? Yeah, what is that? What is it? When you zip something, it's like compressing it. Yes. So what compressing does is it takes a file that's in a format that's convenient for the computer and changes it to something that's not convenient for the computer but takes up fewer bits. Now, it is sort of weird to think that you could have a message in a computer that's stored in terms of bits and somehow squeeze it and make it take less bits. Right? It's like, what does that mean? If I've got 10111110, can I just store that as 1? Presumably, you've lost something when you've done that, right? So compression, or could you just write it as 10110? Like make the bits smaller somehow, like squish them. That's not what happens at all. Right? It's still taking up a single bit always takes up the same amount of space on the same piece of hardware. So compressing means re-representing that same message, that same piece of information with fewer bits somehow. Yes?
What about WAV files and MP3 files? Is that the same?
They're often compressed. Yeah, I mean, if you zip them...
When you go
from
WAV to
MP3. Oh, to MP3? No, I think those are just two different formats for representing the sound.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah?
WAV plays at a higher bit rate than MP3. So I think I notice WAV files are always 10 times bigger files than MP3.
Now, that could be because it's just storing it in an inefficient way to make it easier to process, or it could be because there's actually more information in the WAV file, which is what you said, that it's higher bit rate, higher quality. But if you take the MP3 and you turn it into the WAV file, it still gets bigger. And certainly it's not adding more detail, it's just adding more size. And so part of it is because it's optimized for easy manipulation and not for compactness. So back in the day, when making a piece of hardware to play the sound at in real time, so that it's not played in slow motion, that would be a really bummer. It would actually have to play out in real time. To do that, the bits have to be, there has to be very little processing that happens to each of the bits to turn it into sound. Nowadays, computer processors are so fast that they can actually store it in a fairly compressed way. And when it's time to play it, uncompress it, figure out what's going on, do all kinds of corrections and so forth, and then play it, and still, you never miss a beat. So while the computer's doing 12 other things, right? So that's one of the reasons that you get different formats over time. They're actually optimizing for different processes. So what I'd like to do is just take one idea out of Chapter 6, the Huffman coding, and talk about it. Now, the book chapter does not go into details about this. So if you want to know more background, the book isn't going to be that helpful. But the Wikipedia page, at least last year, was very good. So you could probably check that. I'm sure it's excellent. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to explain how we encode one particular message in terms of a series of bits and then look at different ways that we could do that and see that some are smaller than others. And that's, you know, compression is about choosing a representation that uses as few bits as possible to get the same information across. So this is Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, which people should be familiar with. 47 years ago, perished from the earth, right? So there's a whole bunch of letters here. What we're going to do is we're going to simplify representing this particular passage by saying, well, just for the purposes of right now, let's make all the uppercase letters lowercase. So the whole thing is lowercase. Let's turn all the punctuation into just comma, dash, period, question mark, and space, and new line, I guess. Yeah, I'm not sure what B means, but oh, break, line break. Okay. So, and then let's count up how many of each of the characters that we get when we're if you have to. The way we're going to represent the Gettysburg Address is going to be as a series of characters. So which characters actually show up? We have space, line break, comma, dash, period, question mark, the letters A through Z. Those all show up some number of times in the address. And I actually counted them up. So there's 68 I's in the Gettysburg Address. There turned out to be no X's for whatever reason. All right, so that's a different representation. We've lost the ordering for a second, but that's okay. What we're going to do is we're going to make up a code for each of these letters, and the way we represent the Gettysburg Address, the code's going to be in terms of bits. To represent 4 score, we're going to put the code for F, and then the code for O, and then the code for U, and so forth. So the whole thing is just going to be a concatenation of bits. Each pattern of bits represents one of the letters. So the first way we're going to talk about doing this is what's called ASCII. So ASCII, it's like the American Standard Code for Information Interchange, I think. I think in the 60s, somebody said, hey, we need, instead of everybody who writing a program come up with their own mapping from the letters in English to codes, to bit patterns, we'll just do it once, and then everybody should use the same thing. It's going to make the data easier to exchange between computers. So they came up with a standard. And the standard was to have each character that you might want to represent in the computer's memory with a pattern of 8 bits. 8 was convenient for a whole lot of reasons, but it turns out with 8 bits, you can represent a total of 2^8, or 256 different characters. And that's more than enough to get all the letters, all the capitals, the capital letters, all the numbers, all the punctuation, a whole bunch of control codes and other special characters. There's plenty of room there. So the Gettysburg Address is 1,482 characters long. And if each of those characters is represented with an 8-bit code, the total length of the whole Gettysburg Address is going to be, what, 1,482 times 8. So a total of 11,856 bits to represent the whole Gettysburg Address in ASCII. Okay. So that's one way to do it. We're going to figure out more and more compact ways of representing the same information. So here's number 2. It turns out that since in this particular case, I said there's only lowercase letters, there's no numbers at all, there's only a couple punctuation marks. There's a total of 32 different characters that actually show up. Well, with 32 characters, we don't need 8 bits. We can do it with 5 bits, because 2^5 is 32. There's 32 different 5-bit patterns. So, with 5 bits per character, we get a total of 7,410 bits, which is less than 2/3 the size of the original message. So if we represent it in regular ASCII, we get a certain length. If we represent it in this sort of compressed ASCII where there's only 32 different letters that we can use, it goes to like 2/3 the size of what it was before. Same information, but it's just less redundant. There's less extra bits that aren't really being used for anything. And we can get it down to 62%. So what's amazing to me is we can go down even further than this. Here's the 5-bit patterns for representing space, line break, comma. I just made these up, but I made them up in a way so that at least the letters would be in order. So now, okay, so if we wanted to represent the word 4 from 4 score and 7 years ago, let's just do that so that it's clear what's going on here. So we want to represent the word F-O-U-R in bits. We have our handy-dandy table that maps between characters and bits, and we're just going to write them out left to right. So the F, what's the pattern for F?
0, 1, 0, 1, 1.
Okay. And then O is 10100. And then U is 11010. And then R is 10111. Okay? So, to our eyes, we think of the word 4, but inside the computer it ends up being expanded out to this sequence of bits. We can go in both directions. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to write a message to you in bits, and then you have to turn it back into letters. Okay? So, let's see. All right. So this is a message. What did I say? First of all, how many characters is it? Can you tell?
Three.
How can you tell? There's 15 bits, and each character is 5 bits, so there must be 3 characters there. Hi. So I just gave you a stream of bits, but because you know they're in 5-bit chunks, you can break it up and say, okay, the first 5 bits is a character, the second 5 bits is a character, and the third 5 bits is a character. The first one, let's see, 01101, if you look through, they're sorted. That's actually corresponding to H. The next one, 01110, is corresponding to I, and then 0010 is a period. So, all right. So you can go back and forth between, I could give you a message, you could turn it into a pattern of bits. I can give you a pattern of bits, you can turn it back into a message. Are there any messages that you can't turn into bits? What about that message? There's no code for number sign, there's no code for 7. So you can't, as long as you stay within this character set, you can write them all. Okay, so but yes, as long as you're within this character set. Are there any patterns of bits that I can give you that you can't turn into a message? What about that? That doesn't correspond to any message at all, right? 011, it's not a whole character. So not every pattern of bits turns into a message. They have to be, in this case, the number of bits has to be a multiple of 5. Is it the case that every message that is a multiple of 5 number of bits corresponds to a message? Are there any 5-bit patterns that aren't up here? The answer is no. All 32 of them correspond to some character in this list. Okay? So this is a pattern that's an encoding of the message. It's fairly compact and very easy to go, very easy to work with, to go back and forth. But it's not as compact as we can be. So here's the cool insight. So if there's one thing that you should remember about compression and how compression works, it's this one idea. Some characters are much more common than others. So if the common characters have short codes, the whole message could be said with fewer bits. So here's the basic idea. We're going to take the... Here's one thing that we're going to do. We're going to take the 4 most common characters and give each of them a 3-bit code. And then the remainder of the characters, the other 28, are going to get 6-bit codes. So here's... It looks like an American flag almost, right? Here's the way we're going to map it out. I'll take space, E, T, and A, and we'll give them really short codes. 000, 001, 010, 011. And then all the other codes are going to get much longer 6-bit codes. Well, it looks like we've made things longer, right? Certainly this code list is a lot longer because most of the characters now have 6-bit codes where they used to have 5-bit codes. But what about the Gettysburg Address? We're going to get back to that in a moment. But first, apparently we have to figure out how to work with this code. So, notice one tricky thing that I did. Look at all the 3-bit codes. They all start with 0. All the other codes all start with 1s. And I did that to make it easier to decode messages. So let's take our message that says 4, or that said 4 in the old code, and figure out what it says now. I actually have no idea what this is going to say. But we're going to turn this pattern into a message.